KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Orchards of 82nd grand opening on Thursday, April 25th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Orchards of 82nd in Portland. Rose Community Development will be celebrating the grand opening of the Orchards of 82nd, a fully affordable housing community in partnership with the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, Oregon Metro, Portland General Electric, Portland Housing Bureau, Home Forward, Prosper Portland, Oregon Housing and Community Services, and Sarah Architects. The event will welcome 48 new families into new affordable housing. Again, that's the Orchards of 82nd grand opening on Thursday, April 25th from 4 to 6 p.m. at Orchards of 82nd, 8118 Southeast Division Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Community Radio at 90.7 FM and online at kboo.fm. Today we'll be talking with Portland-based but often jet-setting photographer Susan Soiber about her series A Typology of Lament, on exhibition now through June 1st at Froelich Gallery in the Pearl District. Susan, thank you so much for being here. I feel like we should have started broadcasting earlier in our conversation, because before officially starting the interview, we were nerding out about the recent events and the photo of the black hole and the whole world camera.
We can talk about how photography has advanced humanity for the show and just ignore what I've done.
Well, I think it's interesting because your work is so antique in process, and so you're kind of going the opposite direction in certain ways.
But that's true. But I like to combine.
Yeah, combine, you know, process.
Process.
Yeah, that's okay. One of my main curiosities, as you know, somebody who looks at photography a lot and gets asked about photography a lot, working at the front desk at Blue Sky. It's really interesting to me how artists combine processes and how, you know, all of the technology is at your disposal now. And it's kind of just, you know, what's your show about and what are the tools you're going to use to make it
look the
way you want it to look. So how do you arrive at that, though? Do you arrive at the process first? Are you like, I really want to get into this ambrotype and then think about what you want to photograph, or flip it on its head and find a subject and decide on the process?
Yeah, so I would go with number two.
Yeah.
I usually decide what my concept is, which is usually heavily entrenched in some sort of emotion, and then I decide which tool in the photography box would be best to enhance the emotive qualities of that idea. Mm-hmm. And so that's usually how I start.
Yeah. I know also just from seeing your previous exhibitions at Froelich Gallery that you're also, ambrotype is not the only wet plate process you use too. And
where did you get experience learning these really antique processes?
So I got my BFA at the Pacific Northwest College of Art, and at the time it was part of the Portland Art Museum.
Yeah.
It was one of eight colleges at the time that was attached to a museum, which was part of the appeal. The other part of the appeal was that it was in Portland, Oregon, which at the time was a pretty undiscovered city.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a beautiful thing to come out here. It's I think photography in the West is heavily entrenched in the landscape. I mean, you have an enormous amount of history of photography here with Carlton Watkins.
Mm-hmm.
Ansel Adams. I mean, the list is pretty big and pretty influential. Minor White was a Portlander, mm-hmm. So you have this long history here of photography. So it's a nice place to come,
mm-hmm.
And you're not so entrenched in the landscape here as you would be if you were, I would say, if you were in California, for instance. Mm-hmm. So the Northwest is really attached, I think, to the gorge and to places like that.
In terms of natural
beauty.
Yeah, natural beauty, the coast.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's not, unlike the Midwest, so you photojournalism and, mm-hmm. and all that. You don't really have that here. You didn't have that platform. It was more about formalism and beauty. And yeah. I think that's where my plinth was formed, was at the art school.
Great. You'd never done photography prior to going to school, to art school?
I had done a little bit in high school, and I really thought it was fun.
Yeah.
But I never thought that would be a legitimate way to have a, you know, make a living or have a career.
And here we are.
And here we are.
That's wonderful. No, that's really inspiring. I think everyone wants to know kind of the steps that you take to get to a place where you have a rep and you're represented by galleries and you are mandated to do some social media postings, so, which is great. I mean, social media is a nice stark opposite from the AmbroType process, but can you tell me a little bit about your social media experience and with being a professional photographer?
So have I embraced social media? And I guess the answer would be yes and no. Yes, I have embraced it as a way to disseminate information, mm-hmm. as a way to participate in this dialogue that exists in this ethereal world of digital.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I find that it feels very unreal, that you lose a little bit of these real connections. On the other hand, it's a way to make real connections, mm-hmm. because I know a lot of people who meet and form communities with their commonalities that they find online. So I hate to sort of dish it, you know, completely, because I think there are some positive things about it. But I feel like the immediacy of it and the fleeting moment nature of the social media is sort of unfortunate. I really like making objects and having time to sit and look at them and contemplate them. And part of it is that I live in a house that has a really nice collection of prints. And there's something that is pretty wonderful about living with art, about living in an environment where you have these things that you can stare at for endless amounts of time. And I think that's lost in today's kind of computer world, where everything is just instantaneous and go, 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 go. And then, okay, we've seen that. What do you have that's new? What do you have that's new? What do you have that's new? I feel like that's always the question. It's not like you can do one thing and then be done with it and that's your life. You have to constantly be reinventing yourself. You have to constantly be making new things in order to stay relevant. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of pressure there.
Yeah. That's true. So the manual process of photography is definitely gives you that meditation, that slow down, and introspection. And I have to say, sitting with the prints and look as a viewer looking at those finished glass pieces, I mean, they're you can't photograph them very well. You can't re-photograph them, I should say. They're really hard to take in unless you're looking at them in person. This is the depth of the image is just...
Yeah, I remember I made a piece when I was working on my thesis project back in 1991. And I remember this, I was making these really black, dark prints and playing with the, you know, the blacks in the zone system. And there was, you know, no such thing as the internet at that time. And I remember at one point I saw myself in the reflection of this black piece of paper and I realized that you could create a mirror. And when I learned the AmbroType process, that was even more, that became even more clear.
Yeah.
So they are not Instagrammable unless you actually scan the plate. To try to take a picture of them is extremely difficult because you're going to end up with a mirror surface.
Right.
You're going to end up getting a picture of yourself. Yeah. And the images themselves are very, very dark and very subdued in their tonal range. And so they lack everything that makes a modern print.
Can you quickly explain an AmbroType process for the listeners who might not be familiar with it?
Sure thing. So an AmbroType is essentially a very thin negative that's backed with black, and that makes the image appear to be a positive. It was popular in the 1850s, so you'll find a lot of Civil War imagery made with this process, a lot of portraits you might find in thrift stores or antique stores where they made these beautiful little cases. And because they were printed on glass, they were extremely fragile. A lot of them didn't survive. there's a really tragic story about Carlton Watkins, who lost a lot of his entire life's work because of the earthquake and ensuing fire in San Francisco.
Oh my goodness, yes.
So it's really fickle. It's very difficult to work with. But that said, there are some modern places now providing the chemistry. So you can buy a kit or you can take a class, and it's really a lot of fun. And it actually feels like a lot of magic when you make one,
yes,
because it just comes up in the dark room, and the amount of detail. I mean, everyone likes to talk about megapixels these days, but when you scan an 8x10 negative, there's really nothing that will match that resolution.
Mm-mm.
So it becomes like the Doppler effect when you look at the prints, because there's all of the subtlety and depth of field and from light to dark, and then, of course, the level of detail. It's almost like you're looking at the object itself.
Yeah.
So it's really beautiful. But so it's the reason why it's called wet plate is that you have to pour collodion onto a piece of glass, and collodion is gun cotton dissolved in ether, so it's kind of difficult to work with and smelly.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to work in a well-ventilated mm-hmm. area. And then you put that collodion, as soon as it sets up, kind of like jello, you put that into a vertical silver bath. The silver nitrate attaches to the collodion. It takes about 3 or 4 minutes. And then while the plate is still wet, you put it into the camera and expose it. And then you take it back into the darkroom after it's been exposed, and you develop it and fix it and wash it and then dry it all within, it takes about 15 to 20 minutes from start to finish.
Okay, so yes, it's quite a time commitment. And each step of that process is super sensitive
to
your
step,
touch.
Right.
Yeah.
Each step in the process is a recipe for failure.
And those glass plates are so heavy.
Some of the plates are heavy, and they break really easily. I broke a few plates when I you'd get a perfect plate and it would be great, and then you drop it and all gone, so you had to start over. But it's a lesson in patience and perseverance, mm-hmm. and that's kind of what you need anyway for this gig. So
true. So for the Typology of Lament, the title of the show at Frohlich Gallery that's up right now, it's a series of mostly ambrotypes of handkerchiefs, and the handkerchiefs as a symbol of sorrow. And I was wondering about that collection and about kind of the inspiration behind the exhibition, because I know the themes of some of your exhibitions kind of lean towards the darker side, and this one seems just it's a softer exhibition, and that has a similar impact from, say, your show last year of the asphyxiation. And they're also gentle, and they are so ethereal and ghostly. They reminded me just of the way that they're staged, is that it's like they're being used. It's like they're being picked up by one corner and gently draped, and they each have really intricate different details of lace, etc. So where did those come from?
So I started collecting them because I found one, and I really liked the symbolism of it.
Yeah.
Part of it has to do with the theme that I've been following for the last few years, since about November 2016.
Yeah.
And I think we all know what happened then. And so I feel like I've been grieving for a very long time. And I feel helpless about our political situation. I feel helpless about so many things in our community right now. The homeless population is, it's so sad, but I also feel like there's not, what can I possibly do to make it better? And so that helplessness has translated into trying to figure out grieving and how do you deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that everything I've done in the past has been sort of the same thing. In a weird way, I feel like I've been making the same work for 25 years.
Different
iterations of it. I feel like as I've gotten older or more mature, or matured as an artist, or however you want to put it, that I've become a little bit less specific and more abstract.
Yeah.
And so the handkerchiefs, I tried several different ways of photographing them, you know, with a strobe as you drop them or laying on the ground, but I found that the way that they presented best was, as you said, sort of hanging there as though they're being used. And the inspiration for this body of work came from a photograph by Dimitri Baltramontz. My husband, who had a photography gallery, showed this work a number of years ago, and it was really, really powerful. And I'll never forget this piece, Grief. There's this woman holding it, but she's holding a handkerchief and she's looking over the body of someone that she obviously knows. You don't know the precise story of it, but her handkerchief really adds to this incredible scene. And so taking it out of that context and then sort of studying it, what is what a typology does. It shows the sort of similarities over a series of images. So it's taking that historical image and then removing it from its history, bringing it into current times by making modern work about it, but then putting it back squarely into history by using an antiquated process. So it's sort of going back and forth, the ping-ponging of this idea over time. The idea itself, though, of grief has not changed, I don't believe.
No, but there are different ways to process it, and many ways sometimes are necessary. And I think maybe for viewers, too, I think that's really helpful to think about and look at when you're looking at art, too, just the different ways an artist is working with the subject and ways that they can interpret it.
Absolutely. I think it's helpful to understand what the intent of the artist is when you're looking at work.
Yeah.
When you look at art, you become the sum of what you've seen over time.
Yeah.
And that's one of the benefits of being a solidly mid-career artist, is that you have something to look back on as opposed to all these new people, young people. It's one of these great things that, like, once you have some perspective, you can look back and see what has been really effective and what stays in your memory over time. And I think we're all the sum of the parts of our experiences.
Yeah.
And that's what's great about visual art, is that you can revisit that and own your own history.
I love that idea and that connection that your work has to future works, too. Alongside the typology of lament, the handkerchiefs, there are a series of encaustic pictures of nests, and I really loved the combination of those two things together, especially when we're talking about things that are somewhat more feminine and domestic. Those nests are very sweet and small, and also I think refer to a collection of yours, so can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so in I thought it was 2009, but I'm not quite sure now, but I had a show called Science Fiction, and I had a series of where I'd photographed a series of bird nests in amber to 8x10 amber types. It was the first major piece I had done in amber type. It was beautiful. It's in a private collection now. And after I had that show, a collector brought me a nest as a gift, and then they just started appearing.
Oh, no. Once you start collecting and people find out about it,
exactly. So I now have this, I think, about 30. There were 25 when I started, and now, I mean, several more have come into my life. And, you know, the 1972 Migratory Bird Act is, I'm probably in violation of in some way, although I haven't collected them myself unless they were on the ground. But over time, they've either been brought to me by people or I found them on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to repeat that. I found them on the
ground.
I'm not taking them away from birds.
Yeah.
But so I have this collection. And so when I was thinking about, I've been so overwhelmed, I've been processing in other ways. Let's just say that.
Okay.
So I've been processing my emotional state in other ways. And I thought this would be a good starting point to start making a new body of work, is to document this collection that I have now 10 years later from the piece I made back then in 2009. But I didn't want that to be the sole purpose. So then I started thinking about other things, and I'd been collecting these handkerchiefs, and I thought, oh, I should do that too. And they sort of, now that I see them on the wall, they seem to really play very well off of one another. They're both very feminine. They're both empty. They're both centered in the frame. Mm-hmm. They're completely different processes, but they both have the same kind of heady you know, symbology that goes along with it.
Right.
So I think it works. My intent wasn't to show the two together, but that's how it is. So
they complement each other very nicely, I think.
Thank you.
I also really love the encaustic process over that. So that's the wax covering the picture. And I was thinking about that at first. I was like, oh, it's kind of softer and fuzzier, but also protective in a way, too, which had that extra layer for me of like, oh, this is a mother's nest. It's a protective zone.
And our listeners who will be in Portland this weekend celebrating Portland Photo Month and Photo Lucida can learn more about your work during your exhibition tour and discussion this Saturday, April 27th at 11 a.m. at Froelich Gallery.
We're going to be open on the night of the photo book fair, which is really exciting.
Yes.
So after you go to Blue Sky and look at the photo book fair, come on by the Froelich Gallery and say hi. We'll be there.
It's going to be
that
photo
evening.
Frenzy this weekend.
It will be a photo. It'll be so much fun. It's really so wonderful fun. That Photo Lucida does this every year, or every other year.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing for the Portland community, for people who are in photography to have a sense of community because, gosh, we've had a lot of loss lately in the photography world, so
that's
it's nice
true.
To see something that's really flourishing.
Where do you like to see art in town?
I really like seeing art at the Auggen Gallery and at Charles Hartman Fine Art. Those are the two places. I mean, obviously, everything's in that same block, so it's very convenient. I really enjoy the Portland Art Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And outside of that, I don't really get out very much because I work a lot out of town. So, sadly, I just don't have an opportunity to really explore my own community. I'm sad about OCAC closing because I took classes there. I think that's tragic. I'm really sad about what's going on at Lewis and Clark. Linda Tesner is one of the best curators we have. Mm-hmm. And, Merrillhurst Art Gym was a wonderful space for so many years, and that's no longer. What was the other one? New Space Center for Photography.
A couple years ago,
That was
a loss.
So, I guess Portland's going through some growing pains. I'm interested to see if there's going to be some people stepping into the holes that we've had. Obviously. So, yeah.
I'm curious, actually, about whether or not you have any other things in the works right now, any other projects or series that you're working on.
Yeah, right now I've been really heavily focused on getting this show hung and then getting the Seattle show together.
Yeah.
And then I actually am in a group show in Brooklyn.
Great.
So that went out. But it's some more of the handkerchiefs for a show that was curated by Site Brooklyn. It's a juried show, juried by Elizabeth Biondi, who was at The New Yorker for many years. So that was great. And the work went out last week for that. So right now I'm really focused on that. But as soon as I get through the Portland Photo Month, I will be heading off to work for money work.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about your for money work. It's photography. You're taking photos.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get started as a photojournalist?
So I started working for a photographer as his assistant in 1993. His name is Robbie McLaren. He's here in Portland. Yeah. He's great. I'm sure you may know Robbie.
I know Robbie.
He's wonderful.
Hi, Robbie.
Yeah, hi, Robbie.
Shout out to Robbie.
McLaren.com. And so I worked for him for, gosh, I think 6 or 7 years. And we went all over the world taking pictures for various publications.
Yeah.
And then, like a mama bird kicking him out of the nest, he's like, it's time for you to go on. So I went out on my own and started photographing for Garden Design, a number of other publications, mainly doing garden work. And then I got work with Travel and Leisure and the New York Times and the National Geographic Traveler. And so I was heavily shooting magazines and big magazine stories for a long time. And then that sort of shifted a little bit, and now what I do professionally seems like what takes up the bulk of my time is I work on National Geographic expedition ships teaching photography to people who take those trips. They want to go on a vacation to Antarctica, and they want to take pictures of penguins, and they want to know how. So then I go along and show them how to do that.
Wow, that is a cool job I didn't know existed before.
Yeah, me neither. I sort of fell into that too, but this is about the 10th year I've been doing that work.
So, phototourism, kind of.
Phototourism, yeah. And so, you know, the National Geographic brand, as you know, is very well known and respected. And so to be affiliated with it is really exciting. And my next job will be in Bordeaux, learning how to photograph wine, which I think I'm very good at.
Where's the most exciting place that you've been on that job?
The most exciting place that I've been for National Geographic Expeditions has probably been Baja, where in Magdalena Bay we get to pet baby gray whales in the wild, which is really amazing.
Wow, what an experience.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Obviously, both polar regions have been really very cool to visit, literally and figuratively. Icebergs, I had no idea how beautiful they could be. I had no idea how exciting it could be to see a polar bear in its own environment. I didn't know how fragrant penguin colonies were.
Wow, something you don't get from a photograph.
Right?
Luckily.
Thank goodness they're not scratch and sniff. So it's been really great. I think every place I get to go is exciting. I'll be spending a lot of time in Alaska this summer.
Yeah, that sounds like a dream.
It's very dreamy.
Do you work on your own, do you make your own work while you're on those trips?
I do take my own pictures when I'm on those trips. If there's something exciting going on, of course, I'll try to participate. Yeah. So that's where the polar exhibition is going. I would never have taken those pictures if I hadn't been on the expeditions.
Right.
So to be able now to have a place to show that work is very exciting, and to physically show it as opposed to just have it living online, mm-hmm. where it gets kind of lost in the, what is it? There's an estimate that 13 billion pictures are uploaded to the internet every day.
Wow. That's a fact. I didn't know.
I heard staggering. That recently, that's a staggering number. Oh. Most of them probably are cats. I'm contributing
right.
to that
yeah,
problem.
No, it's not a bad problem to have, speaking of. But that's another maybe incentive or motivation for people to get off of their phones and into a gallery for free to go look at these pieces of art in person, these
Absolutely.
Photographs that have more dimension.
Yeah. It's also nice to be able to see something as an object. And yeah. I think I'd get back to living with art or going to art in a museum or in a gallery or owning it. You know, that's really nice to have something that you can sit and stare at your leisure without having to, you know, worry about them shutting the doors, or you can sit and have a glass of wine or eat your dinner. And living with art really is a transformative experience.
Yeah.
We have a lot of Dieter Appelt in our collection, and I can't tell you how profound it's been to have that work on our walls. You walk by, we have an André Kertész next to our bed, and it's something that influences you in ways that you don't really understand until you have the ability to live with it.
Yeah.
And anybody can buy it. Frolic Gallery takes payments. They accept Visa, MasterCard, and American Express, checks, cash.
Yep. The hot
and
tip.
So it's one of those things that you don't necessarily have to, you know, slap down all the money at once. You can make payments.
Most galleries do accept payment plans.
Yeah.
That's true. That's a little known fact.
I own the last show I had at Frolic. I was also showing with Stephen O'Donnell, and I bought a piece, and it sits next to my desk, and I stare at it all the time, and I love it. And I'm a little sad that the piece I wanted to buy this time is not available because it's sold already.
Ooh.
But it's really nice to live with art.
Yeah. I agree. Well, that's a nice way to close, I think. So everybody get out to the galleries, go look at art, go buy your favorite piece of art that you see that day, make a plan for it. You're going to love it. Thank you so much, Susan. It's been a real pleasure having you on and talking with you today. And good luck with your exhibitions coming up.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Art Focus today. To see Susan Soiber's photography, visit the Frolic Gallery. That's FROELICK. Visit online at froelichgallery.com and in person in the DeSoto Arts Building, which is on Northwest Davis between Broadway and the North Park blocks, where you'll also find many other wonderful galleries like the Augen Gallery, the Charles Hartman Gallery, the Oregon Jewish Museum, and the place where you can always see photography, Blue Sky. For more information, too, about Portland Photo Month and Photo Lucida, please visit photolucida.org. This has been Amanda Clem for Art Focus on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Community Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Gathering of the Guilds, Friday, April 26th through 28th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. The Gathering of the Guilds showcases the talents of five Oregon artisan guilds: the Creative Metal Arts Guild, Oregon Glass Guild, Guild of Oregon Woodworkers, Portland Bead Society, and Portland Hand Weavers Guild. More than 150 artisans working in metals, glass, wood, beads, and fibers will be exhibiting their artistic creations, doing demonstrations, offering youth activities, and more during this three-day artisan show. Again, that's the Gathering of the Guilds, Friday, April 26th through 28th at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO's looked up to very much by people all over the country.
Please join us on Saturday, April 27th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. for the KBOO Editathon. The Editathon helps us add missing information to the KBOO Archives Memory Bank. We need KBOO former volunteers, current volunteers, and listeners to identify content and programs of our historical archive. We'll be dealing with old audio, program guides, and more.
Was attracted by the story.
This event is open to the public. Again, that's the second KBOO Editathon on Saturday, April 27th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. here at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland.
And there was a great deal of commotion regarding this event.
More information can be found at kboo.fm/editathon2019.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.